From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of the New Yorker and WNYC Studios.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's not much of an exaggeration to say that all of America is waiting with bated breath for the Mueller report to be handed in to the Justice Department. And then, in some form, it'll go out to the world, and everybody seems to expect it soon. Now, what that will mean for the presidency and the nation, we're going to try to tease out those questions in just a little bit. But before we do that, you might want to refresh your course on the basic facts of the Russia investigation, the broad strokes of what we've learned so far. Because with all the headlines of the past 2 years, this one brought in for questioning, that one indicted, this one cooperating, it's hard to keep track of all that's really come about. So we gave reporter Adam Davidson this challenge. Give us a summary of what we know so far about the Mueller investigation, and do it in 3 minutes or less. Spoiler alert, he failed.
As I see it, the case can be broken up into four phases, four more or less discrete periods of time from late 2015 right on through 2017.
Phase one, the hustle.
Felix Sater, a longtime associate of Trump's, heard from a friend in Moscow that some land was available and that it could maybe become a Trump Tower. This was in late 2015. Trump was running for president, but was still considered a long-shot joke of a candidate.
I will get along, I think, with Putin, and I will get along with others, and we will have a much more stable, stable world.
It seems fairly clear that most around Trump saw little chance that he'd win, but maybe, just maybe, this presidential campaign could lead to a payday. With Trump's blessing, Sater, along with his longtime friend and Trump's lawyer, Michael Cohen, pursued the deal. They did a bunch of things that people wouldn't do if they thought their colleague, Donald Trump, might soon become president. They pursued financing from a Russian bank with connections to Vladimir Putin and his cronies. They employed a known spy for Russian military intelligence to help them get the project approved. They even plotted to offer Putin a free penthouse in this hypothetical tower. Now, they were all outsiders in the high-end world of real estate in Russia. Sater and Cohen and Trump were desperately trying to get the attention of big shots in Moscow, and they weren't succeeding. The deal during the hustle phase, like Trump's candidacy, was going nowhere.
Phase two, the scramble.
New Hampshire, I want to thank you. We love you. We're going to be back a lot. We're not going to forget you. You started it. Remember, you started it.
In early 2016, shortly after Trump did far better than anyone expected in Iowa and New Hampshire, Russian government-linked hackers finalized their plan to sway the election in favor of Trump.
Do we love our country? Do we love our country?
Several Americans with ties to the Russian leadership joined the Trump campaign, including Mike Flynn, Paul Manafort, Carter Page. Within weeks, Russian hackers have broken into the email accounts of the Clinton campaign and several other Democratic groups. The evidence we have so far makes it seem like this time in the spring of 2016 is fairly chaotic. There's lots of Russian-linked groups. Some are doing hacking. Some are reaching out to various figures in Trump's orbit, including some people pretty far outside of the inner circle, like George Papadopoulos. The Russian government seems to want to have access to Trump. Trump, at least from the business sense regarding Trump Tower, is trying to get access to the Kremlin. And neither side seems to know quite how to develop this relationship.
Phase three, the meeting.
On June 9th, 2016, Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort meet with eight people from the former Soviet Union to discuss ways in which the Russian government might help the Trump campaign. This is the infamous Trump Tower meeting in which dirt was promised on Hillary Clinton. And Don Jr. replied, "If it's what you say, I love it." What happened at this meeting and the way Trump and others in his orbit responded to it is a key focal point of the Mueller investigation. Soon after the meeting, things seem very different and not quite so chaotic and haphazard. There are far fewer reports of Russian officials reaching out to peripheral Trump characters. And Trump himself speaks as if he knows something's coming from the Russians.
Russia, if you're listening, I hope you're able to find the 30,000 emails that are missing.
Over the summer of 2016, the Russian government effort to sway the election is becoming very active. During this period, Paul Manafort, who has a history of doing business in Ukraine, is promising favors to people he knows who are linked to the Kremlin. And during this time, the Trump campaign becomes increasingly pro-Putin. They change the RNC's position on Ukraine, and Trump is openly praising and defending Putin against charges of hacking.
I mean, it could be Russia, but it could also be China. It could also be lots of other people. It also could be somebody sitting on their bed that weighs 400 pounds, okay?
We know now that in mid-August, Trump was explicitly told that the Russians are seeking to interfere in the election. He's asked if he has had any contacts with people close to the Kremlin. He says no. 2 days later, he fires Manafort. And there's just all sorts of contacts we now know about between people quite senior in the campaign and either Russian officials or people who seem to be close to the Russians. Donald Jr. begins communicating directly with WikiLeaks. Jeff Sessions holds two meetings with the Russian ambassador. And of course, Roger Stone is communicating continuously through an intermediary with Julian Assange. It appears that Sater and Cohen are taken off the Trump Tower Moscow project. And it's still unclear what exactly was happening with the building after this point, although Rudy Giuliani recently said and then recanted that there were negotiations right up till the election. In public statements and during the debates with Hillary Clinton, Trump continues to insist there is no evidence that Russia is behind the various forms of election interference. He denies any business dealings with Russia.
Putin has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of the United States.
No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear you won't admit
no,
that
the
Russians have engaged in.
Then, of course, Trump is elected president, and we know not all that much about what happened between election night and inauguration day.
Phase four, the denials.
It is hard to talk about phase four without sounding partisan, because the clear truth is that Trump himself said things he knew to be untrue. We have a word in English for that. It's called lying. Several, including Trump's lawyer, campaign manager, and national security advisor, have admitted they lied to the FBI at the time about their relationship with Russia. And Roger Stone was just indicted, in part because of his denials to Congress concerning communications through an intermediary with Assange during the campaign. In May 2017, Trump fires James Comey, the head of the FBI, when he won't stop investigating Michael Flynn's connections to Russia, and possibly Trump's own connections to Russia.
There was no good time to do it. And in fact, when I decided to just do it, I said to myself, I said, you know, this Russia thing with Trump and Russia is a made-up story. It's an excuse.
That's when Robert Mueller is appointed in May 2017. There is still much we don't know. We know with legal certainty, though, that there was a lot of contact between the two sides, between the Trump campaign and the Kremlin, and a clear commonality of interests that both sides expressed to each other repeatedly. But what exactly did Trump know? When did he know it? How involved was he? We don't know yet. And his political future rests on the answers to those questions.
Adam Davidson, with what we know about the Mueller investigation so far. Adam writes our column called Swamp Chronicles, and you can find it at newyorker.com. I have with me today Susan Glasser and Jeff Toobin, both staff writers for The New Yorker, who have been covering this story in one way or another for years now. It almost seems like decades. And Susan, when you listen to Adam run us through the facts, where do you come down on the crucial question of the President of the United States' involvement here? What is the likely outcome where that's concerned?
You know, I was struck by a couple things in Adam's excellent report. First of all, I think it's important to keep in mind what did Vladimir Putin and Russia want from Donald Trump and want from the United States throughout this period. And because I think that starts to answer in a very specific way why there was a Russian intelligence operation, according to all the U.S. intelligence agencies, to manipulate and affect the 2016 election, not simply to cause chaos, as some people have reported, but on Donald Trump's behalf. They wanted something very specific, sanctions relief. Russia took over Crimea in 2014, invaded its neighbor Ukraine. That's a conflict that continues to today. As a result of that, there are these fairly stringent sanctions on Russia, and I believe that was what they talked about at the Trump Tower meeting. And I think the record is very likely to show that Trump was privately as well as publicly receptive to the idea that he was receiving some support from the Russians and in exchange was willing to consider lifting these sanctions.
Susan, there's been a lot of concern that William Barr, the president's nominee for attorney general, will not in the end even release Mueller's findings, or it might have to go through the attorney general and he'll issue some kind of version or summary of it. What do you expect us to actually get when the Mueller investigation is over? What will we receive? Will it be leaked? And will we find out everything we want to?
It's not at all clear is the answer, because we have not had a situation that exactly mirrors this one. There's no set law or template that applies to this. But I think most people believe that there's really no way to fully cover this up at this point, and that the information one way or the other is going to come out. And I think that is a reasonable expectation.
Jeff, you agree?
Mostly. I've been burned so many times saying, well, Donald Trump can't possibly do X, and then he does X. So the idea that the Trump administration would use concepts like classified information, executive privilege, the existence of pending investigations to limit the disclosure in Mueller's report is not out of the question to me. And even though it's true that even some Republicans, as well as virtually all Democrats, have said they think Mueller's report should be made public, you know, more or less in its entirety, if Barr says no, what are they going to do about it?
They'll leak it.
What's their remedy?
They'll leak it. You've got bipartisan legislation that's put forth by Chuck Grassley, who is not exactly a man of the left, and Richard Blumenthal, who's a Democrat, obviously, that requires the final report be submitted to Congress and the public. Now, that may not pass, but it gives you some sense of the inclination to, at the very least, leak it.
Well, there could also be a Supreme Court fight over it, which would really put us in echoes of Watergate territory. And arguably, it was Nixon's fight over the release of the tapes, and when it finally got to the Supreme Court and involved all three branches of government, that was really, you know, the beginning of the end game for him.
Now, the president's numbers, all kinds of numbers, have been eroding and eroding. They're all his negatives are much higher than his positives. His core, even his core base, has kind of gotten to a 30% level. That's no way to win an election, and in the election campaign has begun. Assuming he gets past these investigations in the House, assuming he gets past the Mueller report, he'll be damaged in many ways. We're already seeing candidates come out on the Democratic side, and we even hear about the possibility of a Republican challenging the president in his own party. What are Donald Trump's election prospects?
First of all, I think you're right to spotlight the possibility of a Republican challenge, even if it's not successful. Recent history suggests this is the one fairly surefire way in which incumbent presidents lose re-election is when they are weakened from within in their own party. Obviously, that was the story of Jimmy Carter in 1980, beaten up by Ted Kennedy, even though Kennedy didn't win, and goes on to lose to Ronald Reagan. George H.W. Bush had the Pat Buchanan insurgency from within his party. It becomes a one-term president. Or you could have an LBJ-like scenario in 1968, where the president chose not to run again while facing increasing discord and division from within his own party. I think both of those are real scenarios.
Jeff, same question.
Well, I just, you know, given my credentials as someone who was disastrously and totally wrong about the 2016
I don't think you were
election.
Alone in that. I don't think
I wasn't alone, but I was... I think reports of Donald Trump's political death have been greatly exaggerated. I think his poll numbers, while somewhat weaker, I think the real story is how little they've changed, not how much they've changed.
I mean, I strongly agree with that.
The day he took office, after an election in which you'll recall he won, his popularity was roughly 40%. It's been as high as 45. It's been down to 35. But I mean, it's depending on which poll, it really hasn't changed that much. And that's, it was enough to win. As for the Democrats, I mean, I suppose the good news is there's no one candidate who is his target who he can, start chanting, lock him or her up. The bad news is there's no candidate. So the idea that Donald Trump is going to lose to some miscellaneous person whose identity we have no idea about who it is, I just think, most presidents get reelected.
Is the drama of the possibility of Mueller getting fired by Trump now over, do you think?
Yes. I really think the odds of him being dismissed are essentially zero. Now, release of the report, that's a different story, and we've discussed the complexity there. But Mueller is going to be allowed to finish this investigation. I have no doubt about that.
Jeff, Democratic leaders have been reluctant to talk about impeachment, although some rank-and-file members have more than colorfully called for it. What do you believe Mueller has to find in order to trigger that impeachment? I ask that to both of you. Jeff first.
Well, something that is significantly beyond and different from the known facts of the investigation and significantly worse than anything that has even been hypothesized so far. And, when I did that piece, when I talked to Nancy Pelosi, and when I talked to Jerry Nadler, who's now the chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, they were really categorical in saying, we are not going to push impeachment unless we are reasonably certain there will be 67 votes in the Senate. In other words, a substantial number of Republican votes in the Senate to remove Trump from office. Nothing that is currently on the table in terms of the Mueller investigation will come close to generating that sort of consensus for Trump's removal from office.
I mean, what are we talking about? We have to there has to be canceled checks between the Kremlin and the Trump campaign?
Effectively, yes.
That obstruction of justice, which would send other people to jail, would not be good enough to trigger impeachment?
Absolutely not. I mean, look, impeachment is a political as much as it is a legal concept. And, Nancy Pelosi is nothing if not a savvy political player. She, like all Democrats, are haunted by the experience of Republicans in 1998 when they impeached Bill Clinton, knowing full well he'd never get removed from office, which turned into a political disaster for the Republican Party. They are not going to repeat that mistake.
On the other hand, Susan, I direct this to you. In the Watergate period, when things were getting bad, Republican leaders as well as Democratic leaders began visiting Richard Nixon and intimated that it was going to get a lot worse, and that was enough for Richard Nixon to step down. Do you see anything parallel happening here, or is Donald Trump just such a different figure that that's inconceivable?
Well, I think he's different from both. I would caution against overinterpreting the lesson of the Clinton impeachment as much as overdoing the comparisons to Watergate. Frankly, I do think people are making too much of Nancy Pelosi saying she doesn't want to do impeachment. She doesn't want to talk about impeachment right now. What is she going to say? If she wants to do impeachment, the last thing that anyone who supports it would want is for her to talk about it right now. Because the lesson here is one of process fairness. And if you prejudge a report that hasn't been filed yet, it's going to become even more impossible to convince anyone of process fairness. So I think it will all flow from the Mueller report. Jeff has set out extraordinarily high bar for that.
It seems like an impossible bar.
I think he has. And frankly, I think he is, as we all are to a certain extent, we've been marinating in this, and we have become inured to the shock power and the extraordinary nature of the facts that are already presented to us. And so,
well, isn't it true, Susan, that if a president had a single one of these investigations, like the New York State Attorney General's investigation or the Trump Foundation, and if any one of these things, which now seems so tiny in the grand scheme of things, or the investigation, journalistic investigations as done in the New Yorker and elsewhere, into money laundering schemes in his business career, there are countless things, that would be death to that presidency. And the truest thing that this president has ever said, so far it seems to be holding, I could walk down Fifth Avenue and shoot someone and get away with it.
Well, that's right. I think two things I would spotlight in terms of the gravity and seriousness of the allegations, and they're still allegations at this point. It's important to say that. Number one, literally the impeachment clause of the Constitution, I think, was designed by the founders with the notion of foreign interference in our political and government process. So the core allegations, were they to be documented in some persuasive way by Mueller and his investigatory team, I think would really get at the heart of what impeachment was designed for, number one. Number two, as far as the obstruction of justice, the president of the United States has already publicly admitted he fired the FBI director with the goal in mind of shutting down this investigation. He has apparently also said this repeatedly in his private conversations with aides and advisors as well. This remains an extraordinary fact. And so, you know, I feel that we, in a way, have become too blasé and sort of moved on too quickly from the hard-to-absorb extraordinary nature of the allegations that Trump is facing.
Jeff?
I mean, I think Susan and I really just disagree about the likelihood of this of impeachment proceeding in any way, regardless of whether it should. And I just add two more points to why I believe that. One is the transformation of the Republican Party. What doomed Richard Nixon was when moderate Republicans, including seven on the House Judiciary Committee, said, we can't do this anymore. We want him out of office. Those moderate Republicans do not exist anymore in the modern Republican Party. And the second factor is Fox News and the Republican media infrastructure, which is going to stand by Donald Trump regardless of what the evidence is. No, this is a
no, but
you know,
Chris Wallace or Shep Smith would, without being, you know, I'm not racing to the defense of Fox News, but even that is a complexity, isn't it?
Not really. No, I mean, look at Fox Prime Time. I mean, where most of the people watch, you know, Laura Ingraham, Tucker Carlson, Sean Hannity. You know, this is a guaranteed base of support. And again, given the atomization of the news media, these people are not watching Walter Cronkite and then switching to Fox News. That's the only place they're getting their news. That's another aspect of the difference from the 70s.
Can I just I those are important and well taken points. But I think, you know, first of all, we've kind of collectively, you know, telescoped the time frame of that Watergate thing. That public opinion was a lagging, not a leading indicator of Nixon's fate. And in fact, those Republicans in the House as well as the Senate on the Judiciary Committee, up until 48 hours before that House Judiciary Committee vote, Elizabeth Drew was interviewing Republicans for The New Yorker, and they weren't sure which way they were going to go. The Republican leaders in the Senate, who in our collective memory get so much credit for marching down Pennsylvania Avenue to Richard Nixon and telling him to step aside as Hugh Scott did, that came only at the very end when it was clear his support had collapsed. Almost a third of the country remained solidly behind him through much of this. Even going back farther in time, Joseph McCarthy, when he was censured by the Senate in 1954, and that was the end of his red-baiting, you know, sort of reign of terror, there were 44 Republicans in the Senate. 22 of them stuck with him till the bitter end on that vote. So, you know, again, by the way, I should be clear. I am not saying that I believe for sure that this is where we're headed on impeachment. I think it really truly does rest on the nature and substance of the Mueller report, its findings, and how compelling and persuasive those are judged to be. But I don't rule out the possibility depending upon what's in that report.
Susan Glasser, Jeffrey Toobin, thank you. And we'll be back with more, I'm sure, in weeks to come. Thanks so much.
Thanks, David.
Thanks, David.
Washington correspondent Susan Glasser and legal analyst Jeffrey Toobin, both staff writers for The New Yorker. The novelist Marlon James is writing a trilogy. The first book has just been published, and he's described it as an African Game of Thrones. He's trying to rectify what he sees as the all-too-white world of fantasy fiction.
I got tired of the question about inclusion and then the backlash against asking for inclusion. I was like, you know what? I'll just build my own damn universe.
Marlon James, in a minute on the New Yorker Radio Hour. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. A Brief History of Seven Killings is a work of fiction. But it also follows the contours of history. It includes an assassination attempt against Bob Marley in the 70s. It includes the CIA and Jamaican politics and South American drug cartels, the crack epidemic in the 80s, and a lot more. It's a sprawling, ambitious, eventful book. And in 2015, it won the prestigious Man Booker Prize for its author, Marlon James. That was the first time that a Jamaican writer had ever won the award. And shortly after he won the prize, James told an interviewer that his next project was going to be epic. Literally. He was going to write a three-volume fantasy epic that he described as an African Game of Thrones. Over the last few years, he's delved into African folk tales and history. He's revisited the canonical fantasy novels of Tolkien. And as always, he's been absorbed in pop culture and music of all kinds. Marlon James calls his series the Dark Star Trilogy. The first book has just been published, and it's called Black Leopard, Red Wolf.
Leopard got to me before I got to the river, still on four paws, a dead antelope in his mouth. That night, he watched in disgust as I cooked my portion. He had changed back into a man and was on two legs, but eating the antelope leg raw, ripping away the skin with his teeth, sinking into flesh and licking the blood off his lips. I wanted to enjoy flesh the way he enjoyed flesh. My burned and black leg disgusted me as well. He gave me a look that said he could never understand why any animal in these lands would eat prey by burning it first.
A profile of Marlon James just ran in The New Yorker, and it was written by Gia Tolentino. Here's Gia with Marlon James.
This entry into fantasy and the book that resulted, it originated in a lot of places. You know, mm-hmm. You were telling me you researched 14th century Malian history. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and you are a lifetime lover of genre of all sorts, but especially fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the places it came from is you got into an argument about the Hobbit movie in
right.
2012. Can you describe that argument?
It wasn't even the movie. It was when they announced the cast.
13 dwarves and a halfling. Strange traveling companions, Gandalf.
These are the descendants of the House of Durin.
And I'm like, you know, this is one really white cast. And the friends I was with, one of the friends mentioned that, well, you know, it's British, it's based on British mythology and Celtic mythology and so on. I think he was trying to find a way of just telling me that Lord of the Rings is white.
Mm-hmm.
inn, there's a merry old man beneath an old grey hill. And there they brew a beer so brown, the man in the moon himself came down one night to drink his fill.
And I said, you know, if we went to the Shire and saw an Asian Hobbit, nobody would have cared.
Right. It's this thing where people can imagine a whole imaginary world but not imagine black people in it.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which is not a reflection of the novel, of course, which I adore and take from. But I just got tired of that debate. I got tired of the question about inclusion and then the backlash against asking for inclusion. I was like, you know what? I'll just build my own damn universe.
Right. Well, so the genre that you're writing in has often been defined by this perspective that is kind of explicitly colonialist.
Mm-hmm.
And like sci-fi is like, it's sort of a proto-Western with people mm-hmm. striding, you know, to find, you know, new worlds and conquer them, mm-hmm. right? And then fantasy is like pale heroes on horseback protecting the countryside from the mm-hmm. orcs, right?
Yeah.
But then at the same time, there's this counter tradition of black sci-fi or black fantasy
mm-hmm.
and lately fantasy that is like your book rooted in, you know, African diasporic traditions.
Mm-hmm. In some ways, it's a wider list when you're thinking about African literature, largely because those distinctions wouldn't have happened.
Right. The supernatural works completely different in mm-hmm. African folk tradition.
Precisely.
And in, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was thinking it's like arguably you love, I know you love Toni Morrison,
mm-hmm.
Arguably beloved even, it has a mm-hmm. foot in almost like horror fantasy. It's
yeah, it is. It is. It has a foot in gothic. It has
right.
a foot in the darker side of magical realism. You know, Beloved and Song of Solomon both recognize that if we're going to tell stories about black and brown people and so on, then our conventions of reality are different. You know, at the end of Song of Solomon, you are supposed to believe that we can fly.
And you've also talked about Marquez. The first time mm-hmm. you read Marquez, you were like this is mm-hmm. magical realism, but it's also
yeah, it
Caribbean
wasn't
reality.
It wasn't magical to me.
Right.
It wasn't magical to me. In fact, it legitimized the crazy thoughts in my head.
Yeah.
And Marquez also said it. If you live in the Caribbean, and I always love that he called himself a Caribbean writer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you live in the Caribbean, you know that reality is wilder than the craziest fiction. So I was reading quite a bit of contemporary and not so contemporary African fiction and sci-fi and fantasy. But what I ended up reading was a lot of the ancient African epics. So the epic of Sundiata, the Lion of Mali, the epic of Askia Muhammad, which has the floating city Go. There's an epic about a cannibal witch who is outsmarted only by her own daughter. And then she dies of old age, which I thought was just badass. This sort of absence of the surreal and the supernatural being a mark of realism, whatever that might mean, has always seemed ludicrous to me. To me, the most realistic novel I wrote was Brief History mm-hmm. of Seven Killings. And it still opens me with a narration from a ghost.
Right. So when people say, what's your new book about? What do you say?
It's me trying to write a kind of African epic story I always wanted to read.
Right. So the book is, you know, mostly it's through the narrator is this guy Tracker, basically mm-hmm. sort of a career bounty hunter with this magically gifted nose for sniffing people out. But mm-hmm. he joins this motley crew of people
mm-hmm.
that are hunting for the boy. My personal favorite among them is the wise buffalo who joins halfway. The crew is very motley, though. The mm-hmm. buffalo, I think one of the reasons that I liked him is that he was consistently he's not predictable, but you do trust him and you know he's mm-hmm. good. It's not quite the same for all of the other
no.
seekers. And I was wondering, who was your favorite character to write? And if you could talk a little, like, of the search
wow.
party. And you can't pick the narrator.
Okay. I wouldn't have picked him anyway.
Uh-huh.
It would be a toss-up between the ogre,
mm.
the giant. Again, the giant is such a stereotype of fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
And they're always sort of monosyllabic. Either the gentle giant or the violent grunting giant.
Mm-hmm.
And he's just a motor mouth mm-hmm. who just won't shut up. And he was so much fun to write. And Soglan was also interesting
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
To write because it's
can you describe her a little bit?
Yeah. You know, some people have called her the Moon Witch. She's 315 years old. And she's the only one in the quest who has a specific agenda for finding
mm-hmm.
this boy. And because of that, she makes some really, really drastic decisions. I like writing characters who I have to have a very complicated relationship with.
Yeah.
And hers was certainly the most complicated. She also is telling the next book. So she's a narrator in the next book, so it's going to be interesting.
Yeah, I can't wait. I love your female characters. They're all so tricky. So the next book will be narrated by Soglon, and then the next one by an undisclosed third narrator. And so the structure of this trilogy is notably different. It's sort of Rashomon-esque.
Right.
It's three people telling different versions of the same quest. And it's also like the Showtime series, The Affair.
Right.
And that was, in a way, your inspiration.
Mm-hmm. When I look back, I can't tell you why it happened.
Ms. Bailey, why don't you tell me how it began?
It was so long ago, who remembers?
It was a discussion about it. You know, I was talking to Melina Matsoukas, at the time director of Insecure. And at the time, I'd been researching this novel for 2 years, and I still couldn't figure out how to tell the story. And she was talking about The Affair and how it's different perspectives on the same story and the stories don't add up. And she was saying, you know, this is a great idea for a TV show. And then I'm like, forget the TV show. This is a great idea for a novel.
For my novel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, best affair in literature.
Best affair in literature is very easy for me, actually. Mm. It's The Affair in the End of the Affair, Graham Greene novel, which I also think is the best novel about an affair. And the film is actually pretty good.
I've never seen it.
Julianne Moore, who should have won the Best Actress Oscar for it. It's one of those how did the Oscars miss it kind of films. The End of the Affair, I highly recommend it.
So I was on Edith Wharton kick while we were hanging out, and and it was funny. We ended up talking about a lot of you know, novels in the canon of literary fiction, and you had some unexpected affinities, which so tell me who your favorite Pride and Prejudice character is and why.
Favorite Pride and Prejudice character? Damn. Of course, I love the hero. I love Elizabeth, and I love Darcy, even before Darcy became likable.
Mm-hmm.
I really like the people everybody don't like, everybody else don't like. I really love Mrs. Bennet. The thing I like about Austen is that even her unsavory characters can sometimes be the only people who know what time it is.
Mm-hmm.
And Mrs. Bennet is one of the few people in that novel who knows what time it is. I mean, fine, she's shrill, so sexist, and so on. But
now people got to eat, you know?
Yeah, but she's the only person who realized, I need to get these women married
right.
because these women are running out of time.
Right, right.
And I love her.
Is there, you don't have to answer this.
Yeah.
But okay, what's your least favorite, like, canon novel?
Oh, God, Wuthering Heights.
I hate Wuthering Heights,
too. I keep trying.
Boring.
I tried last year's summer. It was the third time I tried. I just don't think it's this sort of deeply psychological novel that people think. For one thing, I just don't think Emily Brontë had the psychology. It's like if you read Salman Rushdie's novel, Shame, the sisters, Chunny, Money, and Bunny, who grew up in isolation and think they understand the world. If one of those three girls wrote a novel, it would be Wuthering Heights.
Let's go back to your childhood, your childhood influences. You told me that you spent your childhood in a middle-class suburb of Kingston, watching Charlie's Angels, reading comic books, et cetera. What was your earliest comic book fascination?
Earliest comic book fascination would have been Batman.
But then later, X-Men became your thing, right?
Yeah, huge, huge touchstone. The whole sort of identifying... I was a nerd, I was an outcast, they were outcasts. It really struck a chord with me.
Was there any X-Men in particular that you...
I really loved Storm.
Yeah.
Storm because she was black and African, but I actually liked when she went suddenly punk rock in the 80s because I always wanted a mohawk. And I was always envied somebody so really radically defining herself. I like some of the villains too. I mean, like Mystique. Mystique had secrets, and Mystique was complicated. It was very different from the type of villains who just say curses, found out again, or something, or people talking about these meddling kids. X-Men sometimes would win the battle, but Mystique won the ideological war. It's like Don't kid yourself. You went against our kind to defend people who will kill you tomorrow.
She's right.
You know, she and a lot of the villains left a really, really sort of complicated aftertaste in my mouth.
So you, like me, have music on constantly, and you mm-hmm. always have it on really loud. Mm-hmm. And you have talked about when you're writing, you will note on your manuscript pages what you were listening to mm-hmm. as you wrote. And I was wondering, what was the album you listened to most while writing the new book?
Most while writing the new book? Probably Miles Davis' Bitches Brew. Cannes' Tago Mago. Stereolab's Dots and Loops. It gets me in a rhythm, and I think I write to rhythm, and I think I write to beat.
Well, another question. So Tracker, your narrator, is this sullen, slippery, kind of tough guy mm-hmm. who has kind of lost faith in this enchanted world around him. Mm-hmm. If he were a person alive right now, mm-hmm. what do you think he would listen to?
You know, he'd be listening to Vince Staples.
Because mm-hmm.
Vince Staples is wry and sarcastic. Mm-hmm. Vince Staples is the guy who did that whole GoFundMe. Say, okay, you want to get me out of the world? Pay me to leave.
Yeah.
You would totally, hell, you would be Vince Staples.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for coming in and talking to me.
You need me to say something too? Like, thanks for having me.
Marlon James talking with The New Yorker's Gia Tolentino. And James also appears on WNYC's podcast, 10 Things That Scare Me, which is almost exactly what it sounds like.
Number 4, turbulence. It's always hilarious when you're on planes with Jamaicans, because usually when we go through turbulence, somebody screams for a moment of prayer. Like, dear Jesus, please intervene in our situation. This is the thing. I like to say I'm not religious anymore, but I can't listen to heavy metal on flights. I remember the last time the flight was fine. I put on White Zombie and the flight turned into chaos. I'm like, you know what? God is telling me something. So no White Zombie, no Black Sabbath, no Electric Wizard, just in case God gets pissed.
10 Things That Scare Me is a new podcast from WNYC Studios. You're listening to The New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is The New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. You know, you read these stories, or maybe you've been in this situation yourself. Stories about a company that's laying off workers, even though it's successful, and the CEO gets a huge bonus. Or there's a factory that closes while the product it makes seems to be profitable. And you read that, and it seems like something doesn't quite add up. Our explainer-in-chief on the corporate world is Sheila Kolhatkar, a staff writer who covers business for The New Yorker. And Sheila says that those stories about cost-cutting often have to do with what's called activist investors.
When you talk to CEOs now and senior executives at companies, everyone is worrying about activists. They are all worried about being targeted by an activist investor.
Now, if this isn't your world, let's do a little clarification. When Sheila says activist investor, she's not talking about some kind of socially responsible do-gooder. An activist investor is something else entirely.
They're usually investors at hedge funds who buy up shares in a publicly traded company and then go to that company and try and influence the people running the company to make changes so that the stock price goes up. By definition, activist investing is a little bit adversarial and a little uncomfortable. And some activist investors who are very famous, you know, really terrify corporate America. People are literally shaking when they get a call from that particular fund. But it's basically the talk of corporate America.
So the activist investors often pit themselves against the CEOs. But this is more than just a squabble among the 1%. These fights over the management of public companies have consequences for all of American business, for our products and our jobs. Here's Sheila Kolhatkar.
One person who really helped me understand all of this from the perspective of a CEO is Ron Shaich, the founder and former CEO of Panera Bread, the fast casual restaurant chain. He was really the visionary behind many of the big ideas that made Panera successful.
I had the best performance of any restaurant stock over the last 20 years of public company. 26% annual appreciation, 44 times the S&P 500, best performance in the restaurant industry.
Ron told me that twice during his time running Panera, activist investors came in and tried to get him to change the way he was running the company. So I wanted to start by asking you to take us back in time. It's 2007, and you had grown Panera over 20 to 30 years into one of the most successful restaurant companies in the country, and an activist investment firm called Shamrock Activist Value Fund bought a stake in your company, and they wanted you to make some changes to the business. What did they want you to change?
They wanted us to increase our prices more quickly. They thought we could drive more profitability, essentially, by putting more pressure on our customers.
And what did you think about that idea?
I thought the idea was short-sighted. I thought it's always easy in the short term to squeeze. But the question is, what's its price medium and long term? And what time frames are you talking about?
And did Shamrock have any other ideas for things that you could do?
I basically met with them. It's usually the way the game goes. And the lead partner of Shamrock put his arm around me and said, listen, just take the advice of our young associate. We'll help you make more money more quickly. Wouldn't that be wonderful for all of us? And by the way, if you don't take my advice, we're going to make you.
So the young associate thought that he or she had some good ideas about how to run your company that maybe you hadn't thought about yourself.
Well, straight up, it doesn't take all that much to raise prices. But if you want to understand the thesis of many of these activists, the prevailing mantra has been shareholder value creation. Years ago, the average shareholder held their share of a company on average for 8 years. More recently, the average shareholder rents that stock for 8 months. They're really renting it for its economic impact. And the result is we've changed the way in which our companies are operating. You increasingly have our CEOs and our boards making short-term decisions, trying to assuage their shareholders. And in a world in which what used to be the prevailing mantra, we had a responsibility to our communities and a responsibility to our guests, as well as our shareholders, we've increasingly moved to a world that says the only thing that matters is whether I can pop that stock next week. And boy, I'll tell you, that's bad for our companies, that's bad for our economy, and it's ultimately bad for our country.
So you spent your career building Panera. You started out as the manager of one bakery in Boston. Can you tell me a bit about the cookie jar?
Sure. It was. I always wanted to create the company I wanted to work in. I opened a single little store in 400 square feet in downtown Boston. I then merged that in with a company called Au Bon Pain, which was going through its own series of problems. I then ran that company over the course of 36 years, ultimately selling it as Panera. We had changed its name along the way, but I sold it in a $7.8 billion transaction, the largest U.S. restaurant deal ever done.
Can you give me some examples of long-term decisions you made that allowed you to build Panera into your vision for serving this market?
Well, sure. In 1993, we, Au Bon Pain Co. Inc., bought a 19-store chain called St. Louis Bread Company. We then took 2 years, 1994 and 1995, studying the marketplace. And in the early to mid-90s in the food business, you could feel a significant niche of the marketplace that wanted to feel special in a world in which they weren't. And we began to imagine what kind of place would have real food, would have environments that engaged you, would have people that cared. That became another niche called fast casual. And today that niche is a $50 billion niche of the fast food industry. It took us then 3 years, 96, 97, and 98, to make the changes that allowed us to rename the St. Louis Bread Company Panera. Quite frankly, our stock was flat for 3 years. And the truth is, if we were trying to do that in 2019, I doubt we ever could have gotten it done.
What do you think would have happened if you tried today to make all of those big business transformations you just described?
That's exactly why I sold my company. Because the truth of the matter is, Panera's greatest competitive advantage, its ability to make these long-term transformative bets, was at great risk. And I ultimately made the decision that we were far better removing the company from the public markets and returning it to the private market. And that by doing so, Panera would have the capability to protect its long-term competitive advantage. You may know, I was on the board of Whole Foods. Whole Foods was one of the most successful retailers of the last 25 years.
I love Whole Foods.
And yet, 2 to 3 years ago, the environment around Whole Foods was beginning to change. You had companies like Aldi and Lidl coming in from Europe, like Trader Joe's. Whole Foods needed to evolve. But within 2 quarters, activists showed up. We were told, hey, you either fix it in 3 months or we're going to basically call for John Mackey, our CEO's retirement. And the reality is that Whole Foods was forced into a position where selling to Amazon was the best scenario. What do you think Amazon is doing different with Whole Foods than Whole Foods would have done on its own? Nothing. The only difference is the capital structure and the ability of Amazon to make long-term decisions. You want to know what creates competitive advantage? It's the ability to make long-term decisions, which is why our public markets are under such huge pressure and so many companies are running from the public markets as opposed to the public markets.
So basically, Whole Foods wouldn't have been given the time by its shareholders to make these changes that it is now able to make because it's under the safe umbrella of Jeff Bezos and Amazon.
The point I'm trying to make is not simply that the activists are the problem. The activists are not the problem in and of themselves. The activists are the byproduct of a pervasive sense of short-termism that's informed our marketplaces. Why is that? It starts with our active money managers are incentivized on short-term pressure. Add to that the liquidity in the market in the sense that there's no value in being in for the long term. And you have a situation in which there's increasing pressure for short-term results. Activism arises from that condition.
So what are the stakes in this battle? It's not just about you and it wasn't just about Panera. What is sort of the larger fight that's taking place here?
When we live in a world where you have very short-term thinking, the result of it is the only kind of initiatives CEOs and boards will consider is short-term initiatives. What does that mean? Cost-cutting. We're not getting the innovation. We're also, frankly, doing damage across the country, and there's an ultimate implication to that. If you're in Michigan and you're in a factory, and that factory is owned by a company that was just taken over by activist investors, and that company makes a decision to cut jobs, who do you think ends up being at the loss? Guys like me, gals like me have done phenomenally well since the Great Recession. That hasn't really happened for middle America. The benefits haven't been shared. And I think most people have a sense of the problem. They know this isn't fundamentally working for a better country. We want better decisions. We've got to fix this problem. And there are remedies to do it. We can begin by looking at differential holding periods for shareholders. We want to reward those that have long-term holding periods or at least give them different influence in the decision-making. Secondly, we've got to look at compensation schemes. We want to reward long-term performance. The time to worry about a heart attack is not in the ambulance on the way to the hospital. If you don't deal with these kinds of problems before they occur, you cannot fix it. And I don't care whether you're talking about our politics, I don't care about whether you're talking about our economy, we have become pervasively more short-term. And unless we call that out, and unless we go to work to drive structural reforms to change that, this is not going to lead to a good place. We get it. We've got to solve it.
Ron Shaikh, the former CEO of Panera Bread and a restaurant investor. He spoke with The New Yorker's Sheila Kolhatkar. I'm David Remnick, and that's our show for today. I want to thank you for tuning in. Hope you enjoyed it, and I hope you'll join us next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.